Love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage. This I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other.
This is a Valentine's Day edition of On Your Money. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, February the 14th. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will have some information and advice about the financial aspects of love and marriage during this hour, and we will welcome your questions, whatever they might be, about your relationship with your money. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Happy Valentine's Day, Kevin.
Same to you, Joy, and good morning.
Good morning. My lovely husband left me a strawberry and a square of dark chocolate by the coffee pot this morning. We promised each other we would not spend money on extravagant Valentine's Day gifts, so he made do with what was in the kitchen. I thought that was very sweet.
That is very sweet, and you have been married long enough where, and I don't mean to stereotype here, but usually when a woman does say, now don't get me anything for Valentine's Day, that means actually get me something for Valentine's Day. So, but in your case, I'd say you're more pragmatic, so you're to the point where you meant what you said.
I did mean what I said. I do not need a new diamond ring since I don't have one. Anyway, so a lot of people... We are going to talk about some of the costs of Valentine's Day and a number of interesting facts and figures pertaining to love and money.
Yes, we are. Let's start with the spending that will ostensibly happen to celebrate today's holiday. The good people at the National Retail Federation say that $17.6 billion, billion with a B, will be spent around February 14th. That's $126 per interested person. That's up 8.5% from last year. Interestingly, men are going to spend more than women, $169 on average for men versus $86 for women. Not all of that money is going to be spent on your betrothed or your significant other. Several people are buying Valentine's gifts for their mother or even for themselves. And if you are listening to this show, chances are that you live in one of the most romantic cities in the United States. The DVD rental company Redbox, based on the number of rom-coms, romantic comedies, rented in 2011, said that the top 10 most romantic cities in the country, number 9 is Madison, number 6 is Wausau, number 2 is Green Bay, and number 1 is La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Woohoo, La Crosse. So lots of romantic comedies being rented, apparently, in the entire state of Wisconsin.
Big Jennifer Aniston fans, apparently.
Yeah, there we go. Well, I'm assuming a lot of money goes to the usual suspects.
Yes, it does. Candy, flowers, dinner, jewelry. People are going to spend on average of about $37 on flowers, $72 on dinner. Jewelry is probably the more lasting of those gifts, but men are much more likely to buy candy, and women are much less likely to want it. Women would prefer jewelry, and men are much less likely to actually buy it. The problem with buying a lot of these things, of course, is the prices are raised on Valentine's Day. It's harder to get reservations at nicer restaurants. I think you can still get into the drive-thru at McDonald's, but that you have your own special romantic notion out of that. Better gifts might be maybe a special purchase for the other one if you're in a very intimate relationship and you know that your significant other has wanted something that you haven't really agreed to purchase. This might be a good time to purchase that. Also, you might buy something that's a little more lasting or can be used later on, like a gift certificate for a massage or some kind of extravagance, like a nice bottle of wine or coffee. And finally, you may want to pick up a gift certificate or reservations at a bed and breakfast that you can use later on and not try to cram everything in on February 14th.
Very good idea. Now, I don't want you to ruin the surprise, Kevin, but did you get a great big box of chocolates? for your wife or what?
I did not. Was I supposed to?
You got her jewelry, right?
I didn't know if she'd contacted you or not. I buy my own jewelry. I have a large collection of pinky rings that I purchase for myself, so that we don't exchange jewelry back and forth.
There we go. So is all the time and money invested in Valentine's Day worth it?
Well, spending and observing it probably doesn't improve things a whole lot if your relationship is in trouble. Today, anything you do today isn't really going to save it. However, if you are in good shape and you don't do anything, that could damage things. So it's a good idea to spend a little bit of the day just doing something, a specific gesture. But more importantly, try to make it every day. Couples who express affection for each other every single day with a kiss or a hug tend to last longer and be happier. And those who talk more often about subjects, including money, that can bring up disagreements, but just talking about it tends to keep them together and keep the relationship stronger. And married men, of course, live longer than single men. And married people generally report that they're happier. We've talked about this before, but we'll revisit again. The gentleman who brought up the statistic that married men live longer than single men, and single women live longer than married women. So we showed that this, you know, things like engagement rings and men spending more on Valentine's Day than women spend on them, it just represents compensation for the life that men suck out of women.
That's right. So is it possible to put a price on the value of being in a happy marriage or relationship?
It is. It's difficult. Economists, of course, have run out of normal financial subjects to study, so they've switched their attention to less tangible goods and services, such as marriage and love and relationships. But if you're not happy, you're not going to be happy financially generally either. So there are income differences, as we talked about, between married people and single people. But oftentimes that can be self-selecting, because sometimes someone's more likely to hook up with a partner who has a good income, or they might be married and they might be providing for someone else, so they have to go out and earn money for it too. People talk about the marriage penalty for taxes, and truth be told, and this is relevant to a lot of the discussion about domestic partner benefits, et cetera, but being married in the eyes of the law and financially definitely has its benefits in the real world. You know, you're more likely to be able to qualify for health insurance if your spouse gets it at work. You're in a lower overall tax bracket generally for two people than you would be if you were in one. You get someone to help you raise your children without having to pay the person. You can make spousal Roth IRA and IRA plan contributions. You get estate tax breaks. You get breaks on retirement benefits. You get much more Social Security benefits from being married to a worker than you do with just cohabitating from them. You get discounts on long-term care insurance. And finally, you can qualify for more life insurance by being married to a person than you could by just providing to someone who you don't have that piece of paper with.
You know, Kevin, we touched on this before, but to be a good certified financial planner, you need to have a little bit of marriage counselor in you too, don't you?
You know, people, my mother actually was a family therapist for several decades, and people joke when they come into my office, and my office in Eau Claire and my office in Madison, the conference room is set up the same way. There is no big table. There's actually a black leather sofa. The lights are dim, and there's pillows on it and boxes of tissues and everything. But the fact of the matter is that money, and especially as it relates to relationships, are very emotional issues. And I can show all the charts and graphs in the world of how things are supposed to work, but if it doesn't feel right to people for whatever reason in their gut or their heart, it doesn't work. So yes, there's a strong emotional component to managing your money.
We are going to welcome your questions for Kevin McKinley on your emotional connection with your money or any personal finance question you might have. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And it is time now for our On Your Money email bag. Angie says, "Hi, Joy and Kevin. Love this program. What is the rationale for a married couple to file singly? I'm a substitute teacher, so work is sporadic and the checks are small. Would it make more sense for my husband and I to file taxes separately since I made so little and had little in taxes taken out? Thanks so much.
Well, let's back up for a second here, and this is a perfect day to talk about this. Angie makes a huge transgression in my mind where she says, "Hi, Joy and Kevin, love this program." Angie, say, "I love this program." One of the biggest pet peeves I have is when people say, "Love ya." Love ya is something you could say to your insurance agent if she gets you a 10% discount on your auto insurance premiums. "I love you" is what you say to people whom you actually love. So I would really like people to try to say, "I love you" on Valentine's Day. Start it. Note the difference. It makes a, it's a bigger commitment for people, but it definitely makes a bigger difference to people when you say "I love you" versus "love your show." So I, if you're going to say "love the show," I want to hear "I love the show." Otherwise, just skip it, and we'll try to get your question as quickly as we can.
You're a stickler, Kevin.
it's something people have a very difficult time saying "I love you." They even to the people whom they actually love. It's just you just say "love ya."
Well, you know, we're a little shy sometimes. Angie, she loves us and this program, Kevin. Now we have to help her out.
I know. The old joke about the Scandinavian farmer who loved his wife so much he almost told her so. Angie, thank you very much for your kind words. I appreciate it. It's probably not a good idea for you to file separately because, yes, you may pay a little bit less in taxes in some cases, but your husband may pay a lot more, and you could lose some very valuable deductions when you file separately versus filing jointly if you are married.
How so?
The IRS is onto this scheme and has been for a long time. What people would typically do is they would take all their deductions and shift them over to the individual with all the income, and the individual with very little income or no income at all would pay no taxes, and the deductions would be all put upon the individual with the higher income. So if you do file separately, which you can do, you lose a lot of deductions related to child care, education. Generally can't do IRA contributions over a very low level of income. And you may both have to itemize. If one of you itemizes, the other one has to itemize as well.
So why would anybody file separately?
We covered one reason last week. Sometimes if someone has a very high level of incurred medical expenses, and those can be deductible as long as they exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. Well, someone might have $20,000 or $30,000 of out-of-pocket medical expenses in a year, and they might not be able to exceed that if they file together, so they file separately, and then they are able to deduct a good portion of the expenses. Otherwise, and this is becoming more and more common, sometimes people either don't know or don't want to know what their other spouse is doing relative to income tax declaration and preparation, and they don't want to be held liable for it if something should go wrong and the IRS looks into it. So filing separately can help absolve you of your spouse's liability if he or she is cheating on his or her income taxes and is caught.
Well, Angie, thank you very much for the kind words and for the email. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm Joy Cardine, and this is On Your Money on this Valentine's Day on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Love, exciting and new, come aboard, we're expecting you.
Well, if my husband's listening, I'll take a cruise for Valentine's Day or a nice trip to a tropical island and an all-inclusive. This is a Valentine's Day edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and we are welcoming your personal finance questions, your questions about your relationship with your money, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And just kidding about the cruise. Let's take a question on Facebook, Kevin. On Facebook, Jennifer writes, Speaking of fiscal romance, I'm curious to know what's the best way for a new couple to set up finances to manage their accounts. For example, should we have separate checking accounts and a joint checking account for household expenses? That sort of thing.
There's a natural inclination, especially for new couples starting out, to as a demonstration of their commitment to each other is to merge all of their finances and keep it all together. And hey, we're in this. This is a partnership. That can work, and it's a good sign. But it's not for everyone. And I know several very happy couples who have been married and are still married for decades who combine a lot of things, but also keep separate individual accounts. Sometimes it's because they want to have their own control over the money. Sometimes they bring more money into the relationship and they're not quite ready to turn it over and put it together. Other times because they may use it for certain expenses, like business-related expenses, and they don't want to have to separate each one down. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with having a joint account that you use to pay for things together, and then a small separate account or larger separate account for each one of you where you use that to spend the money as you see fit and add into it as you see fit as well.
Let's take a call from Farah in Madison. Hello, Farah.
Yes, I have a question. I am 53 years old. I have some money which came from CDs which were renewed, which I'm not likely to use over the next 6 years. And a lady, investment lady, suggested I should get a fixed annuity. I'm a single parent with a 9 minor child. And she said something about Pacific Life gives you this fixed annuity, which is something 2%, and then something 4%, etc. And I wasn't sure about whether I'm too young at 53 to get an annuity, whether I should still stick to CDs or what.
All right. Kevin?
My preference, Farah, and it's a good question and a dilemma that many conservative savers are facing right now. My preference is that you actually do stick with certificates of deposit. Fixed annuities are not bad and they're not evil. What they do is the insurance company basically provides you a rate that they guarantee based on their own ability to pay the claim. And it usually is, like you said, about 2 to 3% or so. If it's a whole lot more than that, you're probably not being told everything about how that yield is being earned and what the actual ins and outs of the annuity contract are. The advantages of the fixed annuity are that the interest that stays within the annuity, meaning the money that you don't take out, is not taxed until you take it out. The disadvantages are that fixed rate annuities are not as safe as certificates of deposit. They generally have much higher cost to pull the money out if you need it before the maturity date. And if you think your tax bracket is going to be higher in the future, when you pull that money out, you're actually going to end up paying more in taxes on it than you would were you to just collect the interest on a year-by-year basis. They can provide a nice little middle between safe money and growth money, but usually the yields are so small because the insurance company has to not only go out and try to invest the money relatively conservatively to earn that rate of return, but also pay their own expenses of, you know, building these big buildings and sponsoring the Tostitos Super Bowl or whatever it is, and then paying their employees. And so it's difficult for them to invest it conservatively and earn you very much. So my preference is you get a certificate of deposit, and then if you need the money, either for your own personal reasons or let's say interest rates rise, just make sure that the penalty for pulling the money out of the CD is usually only 6 months to a year's worth of interest. And it's still possible to find CDs that pay that 2 to 3% range online right now with those exact terms. So my preference would be to lean towards the CD.
All right, Farah, thanks very much for the call. Are annuities good for anyone? Kevin, you say they're not evil, but who would want one?
They're typically something that's sold, not bought, meaning it's very rare that someone seeks it out on their own. Typically, even Farah brought up that the woman, this investment advisor, is telling her to buy one. Well, the annuities generally pay higher commission rates than, say, you know, low-load mutual funds or no-load mutual funds, and so there's a natural incentive for people to promote those if they're getting paid commission for it. That doesn't make them bad. It's just something you should be aware about, and annuity buyers generally end up paying for that commission. There are some really nice benefits. Guaranteed income benefits are nice. Some people do need the tax deferral, but usually, especially in a low-return environment, the expenses of most annuities eat up a lot of the potential return, which means that you end up paying for benefits, and that's all you get is the benefits. You don't get very much other return out of it going forward. So again, for most people, I'd prefer that they use annuities as a last resort rather than a first resort.
Next, we go to Karen in Mequon. Hello, Karen.
Hi, good morning. Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to you.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you. Hey, my husband and I found ourselves in a real conundrum last year. Unlike any other year before, we actually owed on our taxes to the tune of about $2,400. And we think that it was because we've been blessed and we've made additional income over the course of the year. And we think we might have a similar situation this year. However, we did make changes, so we're hoping our changes with some additional money and, like, our retirement program is going to help out with that. But I found out something that I was questioning, and I just wanted to run by you. What I was told after the fact was that as long as we file our tax timely, and if we find ourselves in a situation where we owe money, we are able to put that money, rather than sending a check to the IRS, we can actually put that into some type of a financial product. I'm sorry, I don't recall what it was, but it would basically go into our retirement as opposed to going to the IRS. And it sounded too good to be true, and I'm presenting that question to you.
As you describe it, Karen, so good to be true that it actually doesn't exist. What you may have been being told is something along the lines of a self-employed retirement plan or maybe a life insurance policy where the premiums or the payments into the plan are tax deductible. And that's a simple thing that's available to just about anyone who has earned income or is married to someone who has earned income. But no, there's no way that you can take money that you would owe to the IRS and invest it and then not owe the money to the IRS. It'd be nice if that were the case, but based on what you've told me, that's not the case.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All right, Karen, thanks very much for the call. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for Kevin, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We have an open line for you for your question about any money matter. Anne in Madison is with us now. Hello, Anne.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I am calling because I have a small business, so I have fluctuating income. It's pretty general. But my question is about organizing and budgeting when you have a fluctuating income. I have my, of course, business account, but then I have personal, of course, and I'm trying to figure out when I open up my financial plan every month or my statements, I'm always confused because there's so many, you know, balls in place. There's always, you know, the business side of things and the personal side of things, and I'm wondering if you have some suggestions on how to better clarify and organize that information.
Yeah, there's several reasons, and as a small business owner myself, both now and in the past, several reasons that you do want to separate them. The first one is that most small business owners, if you're worthy of the name, your small business is the best investment that you can have, meaning putting money into your business is better than just about any other stock out there. And if it's not, well, you're eventually not going to have your business. So that's one way to look at the business separate from your personal issue. The other is that while the small business is a good investment, it's also very volatile in terms of the income, as you mentioned. And that's true of even the best businesses, whether it's month to month or year to year or even decade to decade. So it's very important that money that you have that is outside of your business is invested as conservatively and as boringly as you possibly can find. And I'm talking about CDs and treasuries. This is not money that you need to grow along with your business. It's money that is needed to complement your business and maybe even sustain it if things get really tough. So I would definitely separate that out so you have separate checking accounts. If you have retirement money outside of the business, which I would recommend that you do if you can afford it, you want that invested as conservatively as well. Again, so if the business takes off, makes you a ton of money, if you can sell it someday, great. But if not, you want to have a very separate, isolated account set up for that. And the third thing is do you have the business set up under an LLC, Anne?
Yes, and I do have the finances separated out. I think and I do have retirement, and I do have all those things thanks to my husband. He's very organized that way. And now I've taken over more of that, the finances, and I think, you know, for me, not being a numbers person, I look at, you know, when I look at both accounts, it's a lot of information mm-hmm. to try and figure out, you know, what's going and coming. And, you know, that's another part of my question is maybe, is it something I should outsource to help me organize that or understand that? Because it's starting to become, you know, kind of a cumbersome for me.
Absolutely. Do you have a CPA or a tax preparer who helps you?
We have someone that prepares our taxes, but that's all they do. They don't do anything else to help me with the business.
Okay. That's definitely the first place to start. A good CPA, and you will pay for it, but it will be a very good investment if the CPA is good, will not only tell you what you need to owe for taxes, but also give you strategies you can use to run your business as you see fit, but also do it in the most tax-efficient manner possibly. And then finally, that person will be able to break stuff down to you so that you can understand it. My CPA, one of the reasons I like him is he's really smart, but he's also very, he communicates very well. He's very demonstrative, and he really gets concepts that I can grasp. I'm a financial person, but I don't know everything that there is to know about tax prep and planning and the tax code. But he's very good at making sure I understand why things are the way they are and what can be done to improve the situation. So we'll put up a link at onyourmoney.com later on today, and that is a search engine for CPAs in Wisconsin. And I would definitely recommend you contact one sooner instead of later. They're very busy right now, but make an appointment. They'll be very glad to see you, and it will be one of the best investments you can ever make.
Good luck to you, Ann. Thank you very much for the call. This is a Valentine's Day edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. And today, Kevin is sharing some information and advice on the financial side of love and marriage. And money, Kevin, is one of the main reasons couples disagree, as we alluded to earlier. So today might be a good day to make sure that our money and our marriages are in harmony. How do we do that? Kevin, are you there? Oh, no. Maybe I have the wrong button. No,
Terry Bell.
No, we don't. We
I'm
must.
Back.
Oh, you're back now. You're back.
I'm back.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
Okay, good.
A lot of the problems that couples have with money starts when they first start dating or become attracted to each other. There was an academic paper published a few years ago entitled Fatal Fiscal Attraction, which found that spenders who don't like their behavior are attracted to savers. And savers who think they're too conservative and don't enjoy life enough are attracted to spenders. And it's true in many couples who are together. There is a spender and there is a saver. And ideally, that helps the couple become stronger together than they would be if they were apart. But if there is any stress whatsoever, and financial issues can often cause stress in couples, it becomes an easy trigger point because it's easy to quantify what's being spent and what's being saved. So unless you acknowledge the issue and deal with it head on, it can definitely lead to not only troubles, but the dissolution of the marriage down the road.
So how can couples reconcile their financial differences?
You should start with finding some common area, some Venn diagram intersection that what you both agree upon, whether it's, you know, retiring comfortably or getting out of debt, saving money for your kids' college, or even if it's just we want to go on a trip together, take a vacation, or we need to buy a new car, and we agree that we want to buy a new car. Find that common goal that the two of you can share and work on together instead of focusing on the things that are dividing you.
All right, and then what?
Figure out what needs to be done to meet that goal. And typically, to meet that goal, it usually involves reducing spending. The spender has to cut back somewhat and increase savings. Now, the upside of that for the spender is that the saver has to agree to say, look, if you can get us on track, let's say you need to save $1,000 a month in your retirement account, you can spend everything else as long as you hit that $1,000 goal of saving for it each and every month, and the saver can't complain if the spender is meeting his or her objective.
So how can the couple make sure that they're staying on track?
This is the key to making this work. Oftentimes, even people who get to the point would say, you know, we need to talk about this and we need to fix this. Even when they start doing it, it's very easy to let it slide, and eventually everybody reverts back into their same behavior. So you want to set up a specific time and date every single month. It could be, you know, the first Sunday or Friday night or something, where you're going to sit down together, and that time and date should be ironclad. It's completely immovable. Go over the numbers, find out what was saved. saved, what was spent, where everything's at, and concentrate on the positive of this. Even if the spender was supposed to, you know, cut back spending by, say, $100 a month, and instead of saying, well, you only cut back $50 a month, concentrate on the fact that they did cut back the $50 per month, and then try to improve on it next month at next month's meeting.
That's good advice. But what if the couple still isn't making any progress, or the situation even gets worse?
Then it's time for counseling, and from an outside therapist, and hopefully you can find one who is trained in dealing with the money issues that many couples have, and get serious about this. Keep in mind that the average cost of a divorce, according to attorneyfee.com, is about $18,000.
Wow.
And February is the highest month of divorce filings, according to the same website. And not only is the divorce painful and expensive to go through, but you're going to end up with less household income and savings. Your household expenses, of course, almost double. It's even worse if you're trying to raise children together in the separate houses. And keep in mind that that next person who is probably going to fix all of your problems might even be worse than the one you have right now. And so it always comes down to the Ann Landers question of, are you better with him or her or without him or her? And if you're going to be a little bit better, you know, sometimes it's better just to put up with the issues and try to deal with it the best you can and go forward than it is to say, you know what, enough of this, I'm done. So that should always be the last resort, of course.
Yeah. I'm still stunned that February has the highest number of divorce filings. I wonder what it maybe just the
I think
bummed
it might
out.
Be a, it could be that. It could be, you know, you look outside right now, it's easy to feel kind of down. But also, I think it is a case where many couples who are struggling, they say, well, I'm going to try to get through the holidays and do what I can for everybody else. And then after that, and things don't get any better, they say, that's it, I'm out of it.
Well, yeah, speaking of divorce, Carl in Wausau has a question kind of about that. Hi, Carl.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? You want to know how to divorce who?
Yeah, well, it segues right into this question about divorcing your accountant, your tax accountant. What are good reasons to do that? I can offer some specifics if you want, but maybe just the general is good enough. Let me know.
Have you tried counseling, Carl?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the first thing I would do is express your dissatisfaction to the person and say, you know what, here's what I'm not happy with. Do you agree with me on this? And is it something you feel like you can rectify with more effort or more attention or more time? And if he or she doesn't feel like that, it's perfectly acceptable to divorce your financial advisor or your accountant or whomever. You won't be the first person to do that. If the person has any experience whatsoever, it happens. And the worst thing they can do is try to make it more difficult for you. They're better off saying, well, I'm sorry you're not happy. Let me know who you're going to have to do your taxes in the future. I'll forward all of your information for it. Probably a good idea to write an official letter of termination to the person, you know, as of this date whatsoever, along with instructions on how you would like your file handled and where you would like it sent. Many people are very happy with doing their taxes on their own and using, you know, a $50 or $100 software program like TurboTax or Quicken. Other people swear by their CPAs, and good CPAs are very difficult to find and very, very well worth the investment. So there's no problem with it. But if you're just upfront saying, I'm really sorry, I'm not happy with this, the relationship's going to end sooner or later, Carl. One of you, you're either going to fire him, he's going to fire you, or one of you is going to die. So it's just a question of when it's going to happen, not if.
Well, this they're a little more specific is the whole thing led to a large tax audit. You know, tax lawyers involved, a settlement with the government. No penalties, but back taxes, 50% being paid. Yeah. And,
so you think he's at fault or she's at fault?
Right, and so I was kind of wondering what are legitimate reasons that the accountant's at fault. That you would then say, okay, it's time to separate, or even ask them to share in the expenses of the audit, the back, like the interest, the accountant fees, that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. All right, we get it. Kevin, is there ever...
That's a tougher one because there's some issues there and some damages, and you can request that, and I'm sure there are, you know, channels. I'm not aware of the exact procedure for doing that you can request that, but... you know, many times professionals, they're doing their best for you, and for whatever reason, the IRS decides that it's not legitimate, and whether that was something that was from your situation or advice that you had, that I would actually approach a person and just say, this is what happened, and this is what I'm concerned about. What solutions do you have to the problem that we're facing here?
Good luck to you, Carl. This is a Valentine's Day edition of On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will answer your personal finance questions, whether they deal with love or marriage or not. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is a Valentine's Day edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. And it is time for our Shop Around segment. Valentine's Day may get you to start shopping around for a new mate. It's been known to happen. But there are a few things you should know before you dive into the dating pool. That sounds like the last thing I want to do, Kevin, but what should we keep in mind?
Well, it's a necessary step, you know, for people who are in that situation. First of all, if you are alone this Valentine's Day, you are not alone. In America in 2010, for the first time, households headed by single people exceeded households headed by married people, and that number will probably keep going up. And whether you're in a relationship or not, you should know that dating sites generally report a surge of activity right around this time. An article in the Financial Times says that there's usually a 10 to 15% increase in activity around Valentine's Day of people registering, people actively searching for new mates. You need to be careful, though, to make sure, though, that you get the most reward for your time and your efforts that you and your money that you spend while you're online looking for love.
Yeah. Well, are there some things to watch out for? Any scams that might prey on those looking for love?
Yeah, the internet is a useful but dangerous tool in many aspects, and no more so when it comes to dating. As my email inbox can attest to it, dating and love, especially from people overseas, is a very common spam topic, and that can evolve into online scams. And it typically has been the damsel in distress, where someone says, you know, I really love you and I want to meet you and I'm going to come meet you, but oh no, I'm stuck in this country and I can't get out, or my mother needs money to get out of the hospital or whatever, could you send some money overseas? The Guardian published an article in according to British statistics that they said there could be 200,000 victims in the UK of this overseas romance gone wrong because if someone said, I need money, they wired the money. And it's such a big issue that even the United States, the Department of Travel, has issued a warning in a long series of articles about watching out for people overseas who are trying to scam you out of your money. And you not only will be out of the money, but you'll be lost in love as well, too.
All right. So watch out for those types of emails. Can dating sites provide a more positive experience?
Yes, and definitely, according to the Journal of Psychological Science, dating online is the second most successful way that people have met their significant other, only to being second only to meeting through friends. So it's definitely going to grow, and it's definitely here to stay. But you need to start with accurate expectations. There are thousands of sites out there that purport to be able to find you your true one. Love mate, soul mate. Some of them are free, which is nice because you don't have to spend any money, and it casts a wider net out. Others make you pay for it, and the bad news is you're out of the money, but the good news is it's maybe a little more selective, and you find people who are more serious. But there are some techniques that work according to putting your dating profile up. Men like to look at pictures more, and they like pictures more of when it's just a face and with a very obscure background, not a lot of busy background. Women are more likely to read the descriptions and the text that people have in that. And if you say, you know, you like long walks on the beach, you're a nice person, you're probably not going to stand out. So try to have something a little quirky, a little different about you that, you know, gives off a vibe of what makes you unique without connoting that you have tendencies towards being a serial killer or something. So don't be disappointed, though, when you do put up your profile and send out even ones for potential inquiries for other mates. The response rate is usually about 1 out of 20, meaning if you send out 20 different messages, you're likely to get one response back from people. And in some sites, it's a lot lower than that. So keep trying, keep casting the net, and don't give up.
Well, what should one do once you narrow the field down to a few candidates?
The dating site OkCupid.com, which one of the larger ones, they have a side blog, if you will, where they report back on statistics they find of what is making couples successful and what successful ones share in common. And they actually did a survey of 32,000 couples, and they found that there were some questions that worked better than others. First of all, they said people who answered yes or no together to these three questions were much more likely to be happy and together and successful than people who didn't. And the questions were, do you like horror movies? Have you ever traveled around another country alone? And have you ever thought about just chucking it all and going to live on a sailboat? And the people who said either yes or no, but answered gave the same answer to those three questions, were much more likely to be compatible than any other factor that they found among these 32,000 couples. You can also ask questions about, if you want to find out if they're conservative or religious, you can say, do you get annoyed by grammar mistakes? The people who were more annoyed by that were likely to be more liberal and less religious. The people who said, it's no big deal, I don't care about it, were likely to be more conservative and more religious. Do not get hung up on reasons to reject a potential mate, because you have these same faults and everybody else is going to have some kind of faults out there. Instead, you should pick a few qualifiers, meaning they have to have certain interests or a certain type, two or three or four different qualifiers, and if they meet them, then keep going. And finally, be very careful of any financial commitment that you have to make up front before you get to know the person. And hopefully a year from now, next Valentine's Day, we're going to have the On Your Money dating site along, so people who are constantly looking to refinance their mortgage can find common ground and hopefully happiness and love.
That is hilarious. I think I'm going to ask my husband these questions just to see if we're compatible.
Yeah, you might be in the wrong guy all these years.
That's right. So, all right. Well, let's say you found that special someone. Maybe it's the first date. What money-related issues should we talk about?
Couple things just to watch out for. They're not deal breakers, but if the person has made past mistakes financially, you want to make sure that they've learned from them and aren't bringing them into the new relationship. Some people I know have said, look, I'm just going to treat this in a very business-like, almost like a job application, and I'm going to check up on this person, look at their credit report, look at court filings, and see if they've had issues with past relationships and money. And not something you want to bring up on the first date, but if you sense things are moving along, it might be something to think about down the road. And also, many couples, especially couples who are, aren't 19 years old, there can be a difference in both income and assets, and that can create some problem when one person either can or wants to spend more of their own money than the other one does. So to start out anyway, I've found with many of the clients I've worked with that it is better for you to agree on an affordable dollar amount to spend on things that both of you can afford if you are spending your own money on activities or trips or even buying a house. And then if things work well, you can start to kind of merge things together or rely on the larger income or assets over time. But it's not a lifetime commitment to a specific spending pattern. Instead, just treat it gradually. Be in the relationship for a couple of years. If things work, then kind of move a little bit more towards the middle with your money. And then two or three years down the road, take another look at it. And if you want to keep going, move a little bit more towards the middle rather than saying it has to be all or nothing right away and then forever.
Very interesting. Well, we have lots of callers and very little time, so let's try to get in as many as we can. Maria in Hayward. Hi, Maria.
Good morning.
Morning.
My question centers around a new marriage, and we each owned our own home without mortgage, but I do have a second home with a mortgage. And I have the income actually saved to pay that mortgage off. That's something my new husband would like to do. Other than that, we really have no debt. But it would leave us with a smaller liquid capital nest, only of probably $25,000 of liquid cash. On your take right now, what would you suggest as the better way to go to as far as pay off the mortgage or keep that cash in a safe investment?
I would much rather have you keep that cash in a safe investment for several reasons. How long have you been together, Maria?
A year. 1 year.
Okay. Okay. Congratulations, first of all. Second of all, how did you meet, just for the other listeners?
Just through mutual friends.
There you go. Number one.
Still the number one, right. Okay, here's what I would say. You can pay that off, and it would feel good to have that either no payment and no interest. But are either of you working right now?
Yes, we both are fully employed.
Okay. Are you maxing out your at-work retirement plan contributions?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, good.
And separately. And pensions. One of us has a pension.
Okay. The concern that I have is that if anything happens to the two of you together and you have this paid-for home and only about $25,000 in cash, and it sounds like you're really clipping along nicely on your retirement plan contributions and the pension, you'd be out of luck trying to either monetize the value of the home or get at the value. So I would much rather have you just pay that slowly. Pay the mortgage off slowly. Keep the money in savings. Keep it safe. Find a CD at a local bank or credit union. Go out as long as you can so you can at least get some yield. It's probably going to be close to 2%. But the way things are in the world and the way things are in your lives, I would prefer that you don't make – you've already made one big commitment to each other. Don't make another commitment to having a paid-for house and very little cash. Now, if you get to the point where you say, hey, we now have a year or two worth of living expenses so that even if we were to lose our jobs or retire, we could use that savings to pay it off, then you can start paying off the mortgage itself. But otherwise, do you qualify for Roth IRA contributions as well?
We do that too.
Okay, good for you. Yeah, you're in danger of becoming house rich and cash poor if something bad should happen. So I'd much rather have you pay it off slowly and keep the cash set aside for other purposes.
Good luck to you, Maria, and happy first anniversary. Cy in Brilliant is with us. Hi, Cy.
Good morning.
Morning.
The question I've got is, I've got a 401k at a firm I'm working for, but it's doing extremely lousy, and they have high commission costs on it. Now, I don't plan on leaving the firm, but can I take that 401k and roll it over someplace else, or am I stuck there?
You're stuck there, and you've pursued all the different investment options within the 401k menu, right, Cy?
That is correct.
Okay. Is there a match? Is the employer giving some kind of match to your contributions?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
They're matching me dollar for dollar up to 6%.
Okay. Well, that's a pretty healthy match, so I definitely wouldn't want you to forego that. So first of all, I'd want you to get everything you can via the match. Are you maxing out that plan, or are you falling a little short of the full amount you could put into it?
No, I'm maxing that out and then some.
Okay.
I'm putting right away about 20% of my income in that, plus I've got other investments outside that, but the company they have that's doing our 401k takes high commission costs, and it's just chewing up compared to what I've got outside. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, this is going to be a bigger issue because these plan providers are going to have to start disclosing their expenses according to, I think it's the Pension Protection Act, so you will become more aware of this. But the good and the bad news, Cy, is that you're still better off maxing out this plan because you save so much in taxes. You probably save 20 to 30% by maxing out the contribution to the plan. For every dollar you get in, you save 20 or 30 cents in taxes. So the extra half or 1 or even 2% of expenses offset that. But as soon as you can get out of it, then you want to roll it over into something that's less expensive and makes you happier. But unless the plan documentation allows you to specifically do that while you're still employed, it's very difficult to do that. So I'm sorry you're stuck in it, but I'd tell you to keep doing what you're doing.
Good luck, Cy. Kevin, Angie, who wrote this week's mailbag question, posted on Facebook, "Dear Kevin and Joy, thank you for reading my email. My son said, Mom, are they talking about you? P.S. I'm willing to commit and say I love this program."
So. Well, we've healed one person's heart today anyway, Joy. So
wonderful.
Good. Thank you very much, Angie.
Thank you, Angie. And what's the website of the week, Kevin?
Well, it's twitter.com, but there's been a trend about where economists have been weighing in with Valentines in Federal Reserve language with such Valentines as, "I'm going to extraordinary measures to increase your stimulus. I love you. Do you love me? Submit your information for review and clearance under Paperwork Reduction Act of 1995, PL 104-113. And we will have all of these up along with my favorite one, "Girl, I know a central bank is supposed to be independent, but I don't ever want to be a part."
Oh, how sexy. All right. Thank you, Kevin. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money. Kevin will be back next week. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.